We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580 here on WILL Urbana AM 580. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll talk about sort of recently unveiled find, not exactly new, but something in a way newly announced about a month ago, something that has very important implications for our understanding of human evolution. In 1994, scientists working in Ethiopia found the fossilized remains of what is, well, probably our oldest ancestor, called Ardipithecus ramidus, known as Ardi for short. Ardi is 4.4 million years old, and that is 1.2 million years older than the famous Lucy, which had been the previous record holder for oldest human ancestor. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about Ardi, what she has to tell us about human evolution. And our guest for the program is Stanley Ambrose. He's professor of anthropology here at the University of Illinois. In his research, he's interested in modern human origins and, among other things, teaches on the history of human evolution. Glad to have him here spending some time with us in the studio. And as we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. So at any point here you have questions, you can feel free to give us a call. Well, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
For being here. This is something that there was a lot of media coverage here about a month or so ago. Because scientists who had been working on the find, doing analysis and so forth, had, in a sense, done the official unveiling. Now, this was something that people in anthropology knew about. It wasn't a secret. But everybody was, I think, really waiting to have more detail and more information about it.
My discipline was waiting really eagerly because we didn't actually know that much about it. It was really kept under wraps quite tightly until they had everything well understood. They had every T dotted and every I crossed. They'd like to think they had it the other way around, and we hope they have it all right. But even though I'd been involved with the project since 1994, 96, I didn't know what they were going to reveal when they revealed the skeleton.
So this was people had been in your field and had been waiting for 15 years now, really, to get the details.
Yes, yes, and including me. I was just as surprised when I read the papers that accompanied the ones that I was part of that had to do with reconstructing the environment and the diet. Mm-hmm. And when the rest of the papers came out with the anatomy, I was just as surprised as the rest of the my professional colleagues.
Yeah.
And it really is making me rethink everything that I thought about our ancestors at this time.
So the last really, at least maybe as far as the average person was concerned, the last really big find that pushed back what we know about human origins would have been Lucy. And we can talk some more about how she fits in, but that sort of was the last really thing that was as big as this?
Yes. Yeah, that was the last time a fairly complete skeleton was found, at least in East Africa. There's one that they're still scratching out of the solid limestone in a cave in South Africa, and there may be a few more coming, but we haven't seen a description of this South African one yet, and that's been being scratched out of the rock since about 1996. Mm-hmm. So evolution takes a long time. Getting the facts of evolution take up a significant part of our lifetimes as well, getting it right.
Something that I'm sure people don't understand, people who aren't paleontologists don't understand is once you've found something, how difficult it is, first of all, to recover it, to get the various pieces, and to get them without damaging them, first of all, which is apparently very laborious business. And then, of course, you go on to the next thing of once you have the pieces, you have to work on how they fit together.
This was a really amazing endeavor. When you walk across this landscape in the hot desert lowlands of the Rift Valley in Ethiopia, you see the littlest, tiniest fragments of bone, hardly ever anything really big. And on occasion, when the rains have just washed something, washed off some fresh sediments, you might see a whole tooth row of an antelope or even parts of a skull of an antelope and some horn cores, some bits of monkey. But to find a whole skeleton, it's very, very, very rare. And in this kind of a situation, you have lots and lots of agents, so to speak, that will take apart bones, take apart the animals before they became fossils, and chew them up and mm-hmm. scatter them around. And this particular skeleton of Ardi was such a miraculous find because almost everything is broken up into little tiny pieces and scattered. To find even two parts of the same head are very difficult. And for some reason, this one little spot, which may have been near a little swampy bit of the landscape, managed to preserve most of one individual.
Mm-hmm. And how complete is the skeleton?
It has parts of both hands, both feet, legs. It's got a pelvis. Not both legs, but at least enough of a leg that you can work with. Just a couple of vertebrae, so it's missing most of the middle part. Mm-hmm. And that's the part that the scavengers and carnivores that kill animals like to chew on and take away, the soft bits. And both hands, I think, and some lower and upper arm bones, and just about two-thirds of the skull. Mm-hmm. So it really is amazing. It's more complete than Lucy by a significant amount.
Yeah.
And when you take the left side of a skeleton and you mirror image it, you can actually get something that can that you can reconstruct how it walked and very much how it looked.
Mm. So, and that's it sounds like if you're going to have only certain parts, you want to have things like hands and feet. If you can have a leg, you would like to have as complete a skull because that tells you all sorts of things about maybe how they moved, how they used their hands and feet, what they ate, how big their brain would have been, did they walk upright, all sorts of really interesting things that you want to have answers to.
Yes, and this one skeleton provided the answers from the top of the head down to the toes.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like, I can tell you a little bit about what we've learned new from this skeleton.
Sure.
That we didn't know.
Sure.
Well, first of all, because we have enough of the skull, we can tell how big the brain was, and it was a fairly small brain, about the size of a chimpanzee. We can tell about the whole body size, in fact, if we just start there. And the skeleton that was found is a female, and she's quite large. And larger than I would have expected. Lucy was very, very small. She was about 3.5, maybe a little under 4 feet tall. And many of the her group mates that were males would have been quite large, twice her size. And this is where the first big surprise about Ardi comes in, is the whole body size. The males and the females don't seem to have been much different in their body size. And this was a surprise because we had expected, based upon what we know about chimpanzees and gorillas, that Lucy and her kin, that we would have gotten very large males and very small females. Mm-hmm. So now if we work down from the brain down to the teeth, We learned something from the teeth about the quality of the diet. Chimpanzees and gorillas have very thin tooth enamel for chopping up leaves and crushing soft, ripe fruit. And the tooth enamel of Artie was a little bit thicker than that of a chimpanzee and wearing a little bit faster, which showed that they were beginning to eat a slightly tougher, more generalized diet. In some sense, it's a diet in between the diet of a gorilla and a chimpanzee. But there are no gorilla and chimpanzee fossils in these sedimentary beds that they were found in. So it didn't have to divide up its ecological niche, so to speak, the food available, the way chimpanzees and gorillas do when they share the environment. Now, the most interesting thing about the teeth was the canine tooth. And in most primates, the males have very large canine teeth, and the females have smaller ones. And the males use these in competition with other males of the same species, competition over mates, basically. It's not so much defense. Females have smaller ones, and in most primates, the lower third premolar sharpens the upper canine. It's called the, it's a canine honing complex, which makes these things into weapons. Mm-hmm. Now, what they found with Artie, there are about 34 individuals, and there are about 21 individuals are represented by these canines. So we have 14 individuals are represented by the canines. All of them are small. And then they're not all female. It'd be like flipping, the chances of not getting a male out of all of these canines would be like flipping a coin 14 heads in a row or 14 tails. So we're pretty sure that there's males and females represented in the teeth. And their teeth tell us that they weren't competing within the groups for mates the way almost every other primate does. And this was a really big surprise, this reduced canine size. And that's a characteristic of us. Mm-hmm. Males and female humans differ about 14% in their canine size. It's very small. Chimpanzee male canines are at least twice as big as the females. Same with gorillas and many other primates. So this was a surprise. We expected canine dimorphism, as it's called, sexual dimorphism, to get bigger and bigger as we went back beyond Lucy. But it didn't. Lucy also shares these small canines. And we can come back to this in a little bit, and I'll just go down to the next most important part in the upper body was the hand. Now, chimpanzees and gorillas walk on their knuckles of the middle joint of their fingers. And when they're doing that, they have to have strong supports to prevent their hands from bending backwards so that they don't end up on the heels of their palms when they're walking. It helps them be a little bit taller, so to speak, when they're on all fours. And they have a lot of stiffening mechanisms that prevent their wrists from going way back and their fingers from going way back. They don't have as much flexibility in their hands. Artie seems to have not had these knuckle-walking adaptations. And this is one of the biggest surprises because we look at modern gorillas and chimpanzees as a model for what it was like with our last common ancestor. And we would have expected that at 4.5 million years old that Artie would be a knuckle walker. And I was among those who expected this. Some researchers have even argued that Lucy herself had traces of the knuckle walking behavior in her hands. This had been debated and argued about, but I was actually on the side of I think it should be. But I'm not an anatomist, so I really couldn't be sure if I knew all the arguments, whether the evidence was really there. But I had this expectation set up. And so I was blown away to see that these hands were not the hands of a knuckle walker. One of the significant things about this, other than it says something about the possibility that our ancestor, the last common ancestor of chimps and gorillas, was not a knuckle walker, is that it makes the hand a bit more flexible and a bit more easy for the bearer of these hands to manipulate tools in a more sophisticated fashion. Now, we don't have any evidence of tool use directly until about 2.6 million years ago, but this is an important little bit of evidence that suggests that of all of these apes that might have been around back then, two of them, the chimpanzee and gorilla's ancestors, were probably pretty stiff-wristed, you know, inflexible-handed individuals, and there was another one out there that might have had a better chance of becoming a more sophisticated tool user. So that was fascinating. The hands do not seem to be the kinds of hands and the arms, and they don't actually have the shoulder blade, but, well, maybe they do. But it doesn't seem to be the kind of hand that was meant, designed upper arm architecture for swinging underneath tree branches. And that was another surprise, because this suspensory kind of locomotion, as it's called, is characteristic of chimpanzees and gorillas as well. So you can see there's a theme emerging here, that gorillas and chimpanzees are the model that we imposed upon early hominids 4, 5, and 6 million years ago in the past. And it may be that we're using these models of our closest living relatives now as an inappropriate model for the past. It's sort of like looking through at a mirror rather than looking through a window into the past. So we're having a hard time cleaning off, at least, you know, me and my colleagues, cleaning off the reflective surface of this glass to see back to what was actually there, rather than what we expected.
Yeah. So somehow the idea is that, well, one of the things that we're looking for as we push back, the idea is that somewhere, maybe around 5 million, 7 million years ago, that modern humans and modern primates that are our closest relatives had a common ancestor.
Oh,
and
yes.
Then there was a forking. We went one way, they went the other way. And as you say, the idea was that as we pushed back, we would start seeing things that were sort of more ape-like, and we don't. That's, I suppose, one of the things that's important about Arty. But does that also say that then really, if you could go back to that common ancestor, that then as you then go down the road to humans and you go down the road to contemporary chimpanzees and gorillas, that in fact, for all of us, the common ancestor would be maybe more different than what you would expect, and that as then the three went down the road, then they actually became more like they are now, and perhaps more different from where all three started.
Yes. So another way to put that is chimpanzees and gorillas, especially chimpanzees, are not living fossils. They have evolved themselves over 5 to 7 million years. It's the genetics that tell us that our last common ancestor was that far back in time, and 5 to 7 million years ago, maybe seven. And ever since Darwin, we've thought that this last common ancestor 7 million years ago would have looked most like a chimp. And so from the 1860s, when he wrote his Descent of Man, up to 2009, we had no reason to suspect that the last common ancestor wasn't a living fossil. And now we do. So, I mean, this is actually one of the biggest reorientations of our understanding of human evolution, of these deep time levels that I think has ever happened.
And again, just to sort of to come back to the point, what we're saying now is that you cannot, you're really not going to learn anything important. Maybe you're not going to learn anything about this common ancestor by looking today at chimpanzees.
Well, we can learn something, but we can't learn everything. We can learn a lot of things, but there's no substitute for the fossils. We've set ourselves up with some well-established expectations for what we should find there. And then we find things, and they don't always look like what we expected. So to give you another example of an expectation that wasn't really met was the last previous find of a big of a skull, a whole hominid skull, was in, I think, 2000 or 2001 by Michel Brunet in Chad, a place where nobody had really seriously thought about looking because most of our finds are from East Africa, in the Rift Valley, where there's a lot of volcanic activity, a lot of tectonic activity, making it easy to bury things. And out in Chad, which is now on the in the Sahara, where the if you watched the television program last night on Becoming Human, you would have seen them wearing protective gear because of the they were getting sandblasted. quite an amazing thing. They found something that didn't look like anything we had ever seen. It had this, it was called Tumai, Sahelanthropus chadensis. It had this huge beetling brow ridge, like a Homo erectus that lived 1.5 million years ago. And everybody who saw it, including me, sort of fell back and said, "Oh my God, what is that? It's amazing." And so we were really surprised to see something that was at the time that we expected to see a chimpanzee. Yet it looked like, well, it had about the brain size of a chimpanzee, but boy, what a funny-looking head. And we're still just hoping and hoping that we'll find the rest of this to see what other surprises are down there below the neck.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Stephen Ambrose. He's, pardon me, Stanley. Forgive me. Stanley Ambrose. Stephen Ambrose is somebody else.
I'm not the historian.
No, not the historian. Stan Ambrose, he's a professor of anthropology here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about human origins and the fossil skeleton Ardi, which just about a month ago was really, in a way, officially unveiled. It was discovered in 1994, and scientists had been really working with it and on it for a very long time. And there were a lot of people who were involved with this, including our guest, who were really still, even people who were close to this in some ways, were really waiting for the big picture, for the big details. And it's turned out to be probably the most significant find in paleontology that's come along in some time, since Lucy.
Sorry. Yes, human paleontology anyway.
Human paleontology. Questions are welcome. We do have a caller here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller here, I believe, in Urbana. Hello. The caller there? Go ahead. Should we try once more? No? Okay. I think maybe we are having another caller coming in, so maybe that person changed their mind. In any case, 333-9455, that's the number here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here on line 2. Let's talk with them. Hello, in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I had
morning.
A question for the professor. When you get these skulls or some of these finds, you know, it's easy to – maybe not easy, but you discuss the obvious visual morphological differences and similarities. I'm wondering, what does microscopic analysis or, you know, drilling down the non-visual area way down, what kind of things can you come up with, and, you know, how does that shed light on all these different finds? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, drilling down is not something we like to do to these old fossils, but you can put them into high-powered CT scanners, and get very detailed x-rays of what they looked like from the inside out. So not only can you see the outside surface of a tooth, you can also see how thick that tooth enamel was and how that relates to the diet, for example. And you can compare the thickness of specimens that you wouldn't otherwise want to cut apart or break. So you're not just limited to broken specimens to look inside them. I think the teeth is the best example. Most of the rest of the architecture on the inside gets into very detailed questions like how much spongy bone there is versus the dense bones of the long bone shafts, and what that might tell you about the details of how they moved around and the kinds of stresses they were under. My specialty has to do with the chemistry of the animals and how that reflects their diet. And in this case, where there are little extra chips of the enamel of teeth, I grind them up and I can tell the proportion of their diet that came from the grassland side of an ecosystem versus the forest side of an ecosystem. So in a sense, this is sort of a microscopic technique, but study has been mainly restricted to these high-powered CAT scan x-rays.
Okay. I think that's the question of the call. Let's go to, we have somebody on a cell phone. They'll be next, line 3. Hello.
Oh, hi, Dr. Ambrose. I was going to ask you a question about, I noticed that a while back, maybe a few years ago, they found in a femur of a dinosaur, they found actual fragments of DNA. And do you think that they'll ever do that with a hominid that far back? Because of the bone size, maybe there won't be any left?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. Unfortunately, the answer is no. In the case of this dinosaur, one of the explanations for what these soft tissues are would be bacterial biofilms that have actually grown on the insides of the cavities of the bones when they were near the surface. So they're probably somewhat recent biological things. DNA is heavily damaged by radiation. Simply ultraviolet radiation is a great sterilizer. In the ground, the radiation coming out of the ground is pretty powerful, and any DNA that is preserved in a fossil for more than 100,000 years has suffered natural background radiation damage to the extent that even if it was there, it would be broken apart.
I noticed that Craig Bentner is doing a piece on, you know, trying to actually design with using DNA to create actual organisms that are non-existent on the Earth. Is there a way that you think, I know this is like a science fiction, but let's say 50 years from now, they'll be able to, like, look at DNA from humans and then, you know, maybe say, well, this would have to exist on this strand to make this sort of bone structure. I think it could actually construct these things. Do you think that's possible, or is that just science fiction?
Oh, I think if it's possible, it would be a long, long way in the future. It's one thing to be able to say this is how a gene works and string together the DNA sequence that makes that gene. But it's another thing to make a sequence of genes that have to interact with each other in a series to develop an actual organ or a body part, which requires the actions of and interactions of many kinds of genes.
Great. So, well, thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thank you.
I appreciate it. Bye.
All right. Very good.
Thank
Let's,
you.
I think we have trying to get back to the caller that we tried to do first here in Urbana. Let's do that. Line 2. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I'm back.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
The question I wanted to ask is, you haven't really spoken about directly about what evidence there is that that Artie is in fact a direct ancestor of Lucy, and that both of them are sort of the direct ancestors of humans, as opposed to some line that died out or something like that. So I wonder if you could speak to that.
Well, that's an interesting two-part question. The first part is already related to the younger Australopithecines, and If you just take the teeth themselves and ignore the interesting things with the feet, which I haven't actually gotten back to yet, we can talk about that in a minute. The teeth are really similar to Lucy's teeth. So if you lay out the teeth from Ardipithecus, if you compare them to chimpanzees, you lay out Ardipithecus, you lay out the ancestor, that the species that lies between Ardipithecus and Australopithecus afarensis, Lucy. There's another one for that 4.2 million to 3.8 million year old period. Lucy's from about 3.8 to 2.8. 2.9. You see that the teeth form a nice progression, tooth by tooth, of gradually changing. So they make nice, logical, easy to visualize morphological intermediates. Now, was Lucy and her ilk the direct ancestor of us? At this time, in South Africa, there are a series of Australopithecines that in some ways look more human than Australopithecus afarensis. And this is a controversial issue here. Are the South Africans hominids just a regional variant, or are they a completely separate lineage? And this gets even more complicated when you get to 2.5 million years ago, because there are two species that are clearly sharing the environment. One of them we call Homo, and we usually consider it was the maker of the stone tools. And the other we call robust Australopithecines, or paranthropines. And these paranthropines had to come from somewhere, and Homo had to come from somewhere. And one of them may have come from Lucy's lineage, and the other one from the South African lineage. And this is currently being debated. So we're not sure if Lucy is our ancestor or the South African ones. That's very complicated. A lot of my colleagues don't like to think about such things.
Mm-hmm. Well, that just, I guess that suggests that we, in establishing these lineages, there's a great deal that we don't know. And certainly it's difficult to say that one individual gave on to another individual that gave on to another individual. Mm. There, certain individuals might have lines that have might just gone and then just stopped. And there no doubt would have been time when a lot of these different individuals might have been living, in a sense, next to one another, or at least they would be contemporary. Mm. But then for some reason, some lines just don't go anywhere, and some lines do. And eventually there was one line that ends up here.
Yes. Well, if you watch the third part of the Becoming Human series, I guess that will be in 2 weeks on PBS, you'll see just a case where at one point in time, 100,000 years ago, there were at least four kinds of humans in different parts of the world. There's only one of us today. So there were Neanderthals. We didn't descend from Neanderthals. There was something that was more like Homo erectus at the same time in Java. And then there's this little dwarf thing, the hobbit. It's called Floresiensis. Mm-hmm. And there may have been something else again in mainland East Asia, China. We don't actually know. But it's quite clear that there can be lots of different fossils that leave no ancestors. We know we've had descendants, that we have ancestors, but we don't know if our fossils have descendants.
Yeah. So I'm sure that then the same thing would have applied to the time when there basically what we would have been talking about was different Australopithecines. There probably would have been a number of those. And then I suppose if we take the next step back, maybe we would find some more Ardipithecines, the one that we're talking about, but maybe some others?
Well, I'm hoping that we'll find other things contemporary with Ardipithecus. Right now, Ardipithecus is only known from two places, and they're only about 50 miles apart in the Rift Valley of Ethiopia. There may be one tooth in Kenya. It's only a little bit of a tooth that's about 4.5 million years old. But there's no reason why you wouldn't find it in the southern African savannas at the same time. And the problem with South Africa is that it's very hard to date the fossil deposits. And the fossil deposits are little pockets inside limestone caves. In East Africa, things are stacked up in hundreds of meters of sediments with lots of volcanic ash layers and lava flows that can be dated directly. So you can see a nice stacked sequence. So when you find a pocket of fossils in a cave in South Africa, and sometimes they have these complete skeletons, you're never quite sure whether it's 4.5 million, 3.5 million years old. They can't be directly dated, and you have to compare an animal species that seems to have a narrow time range dated in East Africa, or a community of them, to try to guess the age. And there's a great deal of uncertainty. I'm hoping that they'll find a 4.5 million-year-old deposit with an Ardipithecus in southern Africa, and maybe out towards Chad as well. Well, they found the 6 million-year-old one out there.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Stanley Ambrose. He's professor of anthropology here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the relatively recently announced find of Ardipithecus ramidus, 4.4 million years old, probably the oldest fossil skeleton of a human ancestor that we have, discovered in 1994 and in way officially unveiled maybe about a month ago. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We should come back to, you talked a little bit earlier about what we know by looking at Artie's hands and about the fact that unlike contemporary chimpanzees, she was not a knuckle walker. Apparently, from what you can see by looking at the hands and the feet, the conclusion is that, and other things, the conclusion is at least sometime she would have walked upright, but apparently also sometime she would have spent in the trees, although not swinging like contemporary apes do, that this would have, she would have shown this kind of interesting sort of combination of forms of movement, sometime in the trees, sometime on the ground.
Yes. The sometimes in the trees, her kind of anatomy was actually more common in fossils that we know are about 8 to 15 million years old. And that kind of behavior may not have actually disappeared, which gives you hope that maybe the last common ancestor was one of these rather than our modern chimpanzees. So although I was quite surprised to see that it wasn't a knuckle walker, there's good reason when you look from the past to the present, what came before it, to have a different expectation that there could have been something walking, not so much a swinger, but spending more time above the branches than below them. The base of the skull, if you put the skull on top of a spinal column of a chimpanzee, the head is, the eye sockets are staring down at the ground, and it would have had to have strained its neck to keep its eyes level. When you put, Artie had to have had its head, in order to see straight ahead, mounted vertically on a spinal column, at right angles, the base of the skull at right angles to the spinal column. Mm-hmm. So that right there tells you it probably spent a lot of time at least sitting up, if not standing up. The pelvis, our pelvis, has this kind of broad, flaring wings of the upper part of the pelvis, and they attach a muscle on the side of our legs. That's the gluteus maximus, and that keeps us from falling down when we take a step. When we lift one foot off the ground, we should fall sideways down to we lift our foot off. But the gluteus maximus muscle actually pulls us back up. Chimpanzees have a little tiny, tiny one because they don't spend much time standing up. And when they do stand up and try to walk on two legs, they are basically perpetually falling. And they have to really, it's pretty awkward. Artie had this bowl-shaped upper half of its pelvis. The lower half was more like a chimpanzee, and that may be in part due to the fact that it was giving birth to small-brained babies, unlike us. So it has a hybrid kind of pelvis. When you get down to the feet are really unusual. A chimpanzee foot is sort of more like our hand in terms of how big the big toe is and how far out it is splayed. Artie had a really big and really splayed out big toe, not like a chimpanzee, and actually not like anything we've ever seen before. It's unique. So there was another thing that we hadn't expected, and I'm still mulling over this. But the rest of the foot, aside from the thumb, has the compactness and the strength and the orientation of the bones that suggests that it was walking on 2 feet, and not quite the propulsive towing off kind of walking that we get, but something a lot not quite like the chimpanzee. Yeah. So we really are looking at something that's close to, it's only the first steps towards this bipedal two-legged walking that we think of. Yeah. Lucy, of course, had a foot that was very much like ours.
Right. Let's talk. We have a couple of callers here. Let's go to Rensselaer, Indiana. I want to get in this caller here on our line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a school teacher, and I've missed some of the discussion, so I hope I'm not asking a question about something that's already been breached. I'll ask my question then hang up to listen to the rest of the discussion.
Sure.
My question is there an intense competition to try to bring news of discoveries to the media? Last evening was the NOVA program on sort of the evolution of evolution. And one of the things that they were discussing was some type of a fissure in the brain that seems to be receding in different finds that they've made. And this is an indication of hominids that were upright. It would seem as though that would be something very difficult to conclude from very ancient fossils. I'd like to hear your comments on that, please. And again, I'll hang up and listen. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I think there were two different kinds of subjects in there. The first one about competition for the news. This was a very well-coordinated and well-orchestrated news release timed with the publication and with a Discovery Channel two-hour special. It turned out to be very worth it, I think. Everything all came together very slowly. My part of the work, we worked for 2 years on this, and we knew it was going to be important and that it deserved to be fully explained in the most easily communicatable terms to the public, especially since it is something that has so changed our ideas that we've had since Darwin. Now, to the brain, I believe this is called the lunate sulcus, and it separates the visual areas of our brain from the rest of the neocortex, it's called, this squiggly gray matter that covers the rest of our brain. And I think that they may have actually slightly misled us in the way they described it. I don't think the visual areas of our brain that are in the back of our brain got much smaller. I don't think they got smaller at all. I think that they were just pushed back by the extra growth of the gray matter towards the front of our brain, where we use more of our cognition and our intelligence and store things that we've learned. So as the front parts of the brain expanded, they sort of pushed the visual areas not away, but sort of underneath. So this crease in the brain that divides these two areas, I think, just got pushed a little bit further back.
All right. Well, again, I hope that helps the caller. I have at least one more caller I want to try to do. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you want to comment on this, but a few years ago, a fossil was found near, I believe, Frankfurt in Europe, perhaps 45 million years old. Some of the European paleontologists think it displays hominid-like features. I believe the paleontologists in this country think it resembles a lemur much more than a hominid. Do you know anything about this?
I don't know much about it, But what I do know is that I was away doing research in Kenya all summer, and when I came back trying to catch up on events that happened over the summer, I discovered that there was this big controversy over a complete skeleton found in a lake, and it quite clearly looks kind of lemur-like or something of that ilk, a primitive species. It has a big tail. One of the things that make us apes is that we don't have a tail. It's got a long snout, and those that deal with this very early stage of primate paleontology, some of my American colleagues got fairly up in arms about this, and they wrote some papers about how this is maybe on a collateral lineage, and it's really too far back to draw a straight line from them to us. But nobody's ever really called it a human ancestor, maybe perhaps an ape ancestor. And that's what is being contested, whether it's something that was on the lineage to apes or it was already on that branch that went to our living lemurs.
What seems strange to me was they seem to have another fossil from North Africa, but it's perhaps 15 million years younger, which seems an extraordinary gap in time.
Yeah, it might be a long time, but I'm not sure if it's that much more recent. There are finds from places like Burma, Morocco, China. We have these things in Germany. They're all little tiny bits and pieces of the puzzle. Also Egypt at this time. And this early period of primate evolution isn't my specialty. I'm actually an archaeologist, but I cover a pretty wide span of time with my geochemical research. Gets me involved with these things, and I have to teach it. But there's a lot of unsettled questions about these things that are so remotely related to us, so far back in time.
Well, thank you so much for commenting.
All right. Thank you for the call. There are a lot of other things that we could talk about. I guess one thing that I find really interesting, and it's you touched on a little earlier, is how one could take something like a tooth and look at the shape and the size of a tooth and from that start to draw some conclusions about, I suppose, really what we're talking about here is behavior, social organization, mating practices, a great many things just by looking at a tooth.
That's quite impressive what Owen Lovejoy, one of the senior members of the research team, proposed in 1981, that these small canines and some other features represent a period in evolution in the forests and woodlands of Africa at about this time that probably form monogamous mated pairs. And the males may have provisioned the females to allow them to raise fairly big brain babies that required a long period of learning to make their living. And this was a model that many of us did not like because at that time we knew about Lucy, which had very large males and very small females, and we imposed upon Lucy a gorilla type harem organization or a baboon troop organization where there's a lot of competition between males over females. And now we find 4.5 million years ago that the males and the females both have small canines and they both have similar body sizes. And this fits, and they're in the woodland to forest, and this fits what Owen Lovejoy had predicted in 1981. And the closing paper out of all of these 11 that were published in Science lays out the details of this argument. At the time in 1981, we said, I think you're imposing our modern family way of life, and that included and modern human condition, which included, unlike the chimpanzee, when they ovulate, the females develop these huge sexual swellings around the perineum that advertises to all the males that they could be the next dad. And modern humans do nothing of the sort. It's called sequestered ovulation. And he's arguing that what we see in modern humans in this respect that is interpreted as a strategy to keep one male around and mating with the female all the time and defending her against other males and taking good care of the offspring goes all the way back to 5 million years ago.
Which would be really remarkable, particularly since such a thing in the mammalian world is virtually unheard of.
Well, it's about 5% of the species of mammals known. That's very rare. This brings us down to really what we think it means to be human, because a lot of what we explain about being ourselves as humans is how we imagine what our past was. If we model our ancestor as something like the gorilla, and we have this statue, bronze by Frommier in our collection here in the Art Museum, of a big gorilla with a fainted female, modern woman in his hand, and he's got a big stone tool in one hand, and he's obviously roaring, and his big canine teeth are sticking out. This was nature red in tooth and claw. And to a large extent, we still have this nature red in tooth and claw ancestor as the ancestral condition. Now, Ardipithecus tells us, well, maybe it was something else entirely.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Well, at that, we're going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time. Stanley Ambrose is our guest. He's a professor of anthropology here at University of Illinois. If you'd like to read more about Ardi, I think that people can go online and read that issue, that special issue of Science with all those articles in there. If you'd like to plow more deeply into that, you can do that.
It's a big plow. There's a lot. You need a big plow. A lot of gas in the tractor. It was several hundred pages if you read all the supplementary things, which I have not.
Right. Well, it's there. And thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.